The Hoop Heads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Part of the reason I started playing basketball was I was decent at it, but then the other reason is, hey, there's 3,200 people a night, Friday night, watching us play, right? Hey, I want to do that now. Like, I want to be, you know, I want to be out there. And, you know, now as I've gotten older, obviously, like, I enjoy coaching basketball. I don't care if there's four people in the stands or there's 40,000. It doesn't matter to me. Now, obviously, I want 40,000, but I enjoy that competition. So I don't know if I would enjoy it. I enjoyed it as a high school or growing up, but I really enjoyed it because it was important, right, to a lot of people. And but now, like, I enjoy that competition. Like I said, hey, if four people come to our game or if 40,000 people, I love competing and teaching it and coaching it. And, you know, and our guys, you know, I want to give our players as much of that feeling of, yeah, we do it for competing, but also, you know, it's important.
Jason Zimmerman was named the fourth head coach in the history of Emory men's basketball in April of 2007. In his 12 years of calling the shots for the Eagles, Zimmerman has compiled a one-loss record of 214-103. After going 17-33 in his first 2 years at Emory, Zimmerman has compiled a one-loss slate of 197-70 since the 2009-2010 season. Over the last 10 seasons, Zimmerman has guided Emory to six of the program's seven campaigns of 20 wins or more. Emory has finished third or higher in the University Athletic Association standings in each of the past 10 years and has won league titles in 2013, 2015, 2016, and 2019. From 2013 through 2018, Emory held the distinction of being the lone D3 program to have won at least one game in the NCAA tournament. A native of Warsaw, Indiana, Zimmerman came to the Emory program having spent 11 seasons as an assistant coach at the Division I level. He spent the 2003 through 2007 seasons as an assistant at the University of Evansville under Steve Merfeld. Jason coached for 7 seasons on the Davidson staff, where he worked for his college coach, Bob McKillop, from 1996 through 2003. As a player, Zimmerman was a 4-year letter winner at Davidson, where he concluded his career as the school's number 18 all-time leading scorer with 1,260 points. One of the top players in the Southern Conference, he finished 4th in career free throw percentage and 7th in career assists, and he was also a member of Davidson's 1994 NIT team. He graduated from Davidson in 1994 and earned his bachelor's degree in economics. After you finish listening to this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Those ratings help others in the basketball community to find our show. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or Google Play so you never miss an episode. If you haven't checked out our website, make sure you head over to hoopheadspod.com to hear every episode we've ever recorded. Be prepared to take some notes and learn from Coach Jason Zimmerman from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klensing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, Jason Zimmerman. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Excited about talking to you a little bit about basketball and my career and what we're doing here at Emory.
Absolutely. We're excited to dig into not only your background, but what you've been able to build down there in Atlanta. So let's start out by going back in time to when you were a kid and talk a little bit about how you fell in love with the game of basketball when you were younger.
Yeah, so that's a long time ago. I had hair back then.
Understood. Me too.
So that goes way back. But I grew up in Indiana. And when you grow up in Indiana, you fall in love with the game, or at least you know something about the game, right? So I grew up in a small town, northern Indiana, Warsaw Community High School. And it was just built in the fabric of the town, right, to be a basketball fan of basketball. You know, I can remember 1976. I was 4 years old and went to the first women's basketball state state championship. Warsaw won it. And then I think it was 78, they won it again. 84, my high school won the men's state tournament in Indiana, which was a single class back then. So, you know, growing up, those guys were my heroes, right? I want to grow up, be like those guys that played for our town. And then I was fortunate enough to have great basketball coaches in our town. So we had a small college here, Grace College. Went and started going to camp there, and Coach Jim Kessler ran that, or it was just retired this year from coaching, a tremendous basketball coach. Went to his camp when I was young. But then I had, I believe, the best high school coach in the country, or, you know, you can say one of the best high school coaches in the country, in Al Rhodes. And he really taught me, and I didn't know it at the time, but he taught me what a great feeder system was, like how to build a basketball player. And I was fortunate enough to grow up with and blessed enough to grow up with him as our high school basketball coach, with that tradition in our town. And then I realized that I was okay at playing, and had success there. And then you just, from there, you realize that, hey, this is something that I enjoy doing. And when you live on a farm in Indiana, you watch corn grow or you shoot baskets, right?
Exactly. Doing, right? No doubt.
And so there are many stories of that, just being able to go out and shoot baskets in the driveway or in the barn, or, you know, it's kind of, people see that as an Indiana kid. And that was kind of my life growing up until really through high school. And but there's a lot of tremendous stories about Indiana, obviously, basketball. And I was fortunate enough to grow up in a place that that really puts a lot of emphasis on that.
Yeah, no question. So two things I want to bring out from what you said. One is, you mentioned that you looked up to the guys who played at the high school. And you also mentioned that Coach Rhodes had he taught you what it was like to have a great feeder system. So when you were growing up and you were younger, let's say you were in elementary school, did you have a chance to connect directly with those kids who were a part of the high school team, like as part of the feeder system? Did they help coach or be involved in any way in coaching the younger kids in the community?
Yeah, see, back then we didn't have all this, like, Instagram, Snapchat, all this crazy stuff, right?
So exactly.
So what happened back then was and our town was a little bit crazy for basketball. So we had, like, elementary schools, eight elementary schools. So we played for, like, a city championship, and it was a big deal, right? We got to play in a high school gym. You know, I can tell you my elementary school coach, Randy Polston, right? He was a principal for a long time. And like, the city took great pride in this, right? Now, this is a fourth, fifth, sixth graders, right? So as you do that, the guys who played on the high school team did the same thing. So they played at your elementary school. So you looked up to that. And then Coach Rhodes obviously had a basketball camp. So those guys who we looked up to were counselors in that basketball camp. And so you touch them, and you got to remember, like, there are 3,200 people a night going to see them play on Friday night. So you'd go to a high school game as a fifth grader, sixth grader. You just played in a city championship, but you're going to see these guys play. And I was fortunate enough to play at a school. Jeff Gross was Mr. Basketball in Indiana in 1985. He played at Warsaw. Rick Fox played at Warsaw. I was lucky enough to have him there a little bit ahead of me. And so you got to see these guys, and they were real, right? And I guess a funny story, I went back. I think my grandmother passed. This was years ago now. But Jeff Gross was outside mowing the lawn. And when I drove through Warsaw, my wife, who didn't know me when I was in high school, but when we left, I went up, talked to Jeff, and we know each other. And when we pulled away, I said, hey, that was my hero growing up. And, you know, here he is, you know, he's a councilman. He was a councilman in Warsaw, Indiana. But those were guys that, and of course, Tracy Lass, my wife Lass, is like, really, there's this guy that was your hero growing up mowing the lawn. And yeah, those are the guys that I wanted to be like. And and honestly, like, you still want to be like those guys a little bit, right? And I think that is so important nowadays, to have those people that you look up to that you can touch, right? That you can see, and like you can do those things. And you know, when I went to Davis, it's not like, hey, I took great pride in putting on a Warsaw high school basketball shirt. And since I was maybe eight, I wanted to play for Warsaw and Coach Rhodes. Well, when you go to play for Bob McKillop at Davidson, the first day you put on a Davidson shirt, I didn't grow up 18 years wanting to be a Davidson player. Right.
Absolutely.
I just didn't. Right. So it was a different feeling, and it was something that you grow through. Now, I don't know if it's really right to have, you know, as a 16-year-old, some of the pressure that we had as 16-year-olds playing for, you know, a high school basketball team with the town, you know.
Right. Everybody in town riding on everything that happens.
On you. Yeah. For, you know, you miss a shot, you walk downtown, you know, Warsaw, Indiana, and you may have an 80-year-old man say, hey, man, you better make some shots or we're going to lose, right? And looking back at that as now a coach and 47 years old, I said, man, that was crazy. But it really helped mold me as a coach and a person I want to be. And, you know, people ask me if I get nervous now coaching. I get anxious, but I don't get nervous. I was way more nervous as a 15-year-old trying to make a shot for Warsaw Community High School, right?
And absolutely.
Like I said, I was really blessed to grow up in that environment. Coach Rhodes was a builder. He was a great teacher. And he built program. And, you know, my senior year, we had seven seniors. We had five starters were seniors. We started out the season unranked, and by January, we're number one in the state, and we didn't finish it off and win the state championship, but that's something that we take a great deal of pride in. And guys, you know, I still talk to a lot of those guys, and we still talk about what we should have done at the end, but it's something that being able to build and leave something better than when you got there is important to our group, and it's important to me as we move forward.
So. Yeah, I think when you have those kind of connections between your team and your community. And I think that's one of the things that's maybe lost a little bit, at least in some places in the country, because of the current system of basketball that we have set up for the grassroots level. And you just don't have the same type of situation where kids are. I grew up in a similar situation to you, not in as crazy of a basketball town as you did, but I grew up from the time I was in elementary school, second, third grade. I can remember going to games at my high school and watching the team come out for warmups and hearing the band. And the thing that I always wanted to do, and I laugh about this, is I always wanted to run out in warmups and be able to slap the backboard and shoot a layup.
Like, so basically, guys, he was the original LeBron.
Yeah.
In this right. case, that's layup
exactly,
lines.
That's exactly. I was all about the layup lines. But I remember seeing these guys that, you know, I looked up to, and, you know, they'd come running out and slap the backboard, make their layup. And I'd be like, man, I can't wait till, you know, till I can do that one day. And there was a lot of kids that, same as you, that I grew up with from the time I was second, third, fourth grade, that I knew that those guys were going to be my teammates when we got to high school. And now I'm sure there are still situations where that occurs, but it's much fewer and farther between than it used to be during the time that, you know, that you and I grew up. I'm about 2 years older than you, so I grew up in the same era. So I think it's interesting to kind of compare and contrast the way that you and I grew up in the game with playing locally and going out, in your case, playing in the cornfield or playing in the barn. And I grew up going to the playground or playing in my driveway.
Yep.
And nowadays kids just, to a large degree, don't do that anymore because they're playing with a coach. They're playing with a referee. They're playing with uniforms. They're playing in an air conditioned gym. And it just, it's different, and it's a different way.
And I think that's a good way to look at it too. Like, it's not better or worse, right? Like,
right.
Everybody say, well, it's worse and this. And yeah, I'm sure there's some things that are better, some things are, but it is different. Like, we live in a different world, right? Like, it's a different world than when we grew up. And that's okay. Like, to be a good basketball player, that doesn't change, right? So, like, you still have to do the work to be a good basketball player. And so that hasn't changed. Like, you still have to go out and get your shots up, or you still have to go out and compete. Like I say all the time about grassroots basketball, man, I wish I had the opportunity to play in that many games, right? Because that's what
for
we
sure.
were doing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, would that have made me better? Yeah, I think so, but it probably would have taken away some of the reason that I became a good player is because I worked at it by myself a lot, right? Like
right,
we
right.
spent time we spent time. And also, somebody was able to teach me, like, hey, you have to do this. And I had great role models, and then I had a great teacher. So, but I am hesitant to say, like, my son is 15, 16 now. You know, he just lives in a different world than I lived in. And, like, if I had a phone, like, or access to things that these young people have access to, would I have chosen the path that I chose? I don't know. I like to say I would have, yeah, but I don't know. And so I think kids nowadays, they have to really, I mean, they have more choices than we had, right? And so to when they choose something, there's a conviction there, right? So when they make that choice with those people, that the kids that do, you know?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm younger than both of you, and I still remember going to the games in, you know, middle school, high school, and but I think this day and age, these kids now, they don't feel the need to go to high school basketball because they can just flip their phone on and watch any game they want. I mean, when I was growing up, I graduated in 2005 from high school, but I still couldn't just watch any, like, there wasn't a basketball game on every single night. Whereas now, I literally can flip on ESPN, I can flip on NBA TV, they might even be showing Harwood Classics. I can just sit and watch those games. I don't need to go to the high school gym. And I think that plays a big role too, definitely. You know, it's kind of, you got to get the kids wanting to go to the games in order to get them there. They can't, can't just expect it like it used to be.
That's right. And I'll say this, like, part of the reason I started playing basketball was I was decent at it. But then the other reason is, hey, there's 3,200 people a night, Friday night, watching us play, right?
Like, right, yeah.
Hey, I want to do that now. Like, I want to be, you know, I want to be out there. And, you know, now as I've gotten older, obviously, like, I enjoy coaching basketball. I don't care if there's four people in the stands or there's 40,000. It doesn't matter to me. Now, obviously, I want 40,000, but that I enjoy that competition. So I don't know if I would have enjoyed it. I enjoyed it as a high school or growing up, but I really enjoyed it because it was important, right, to a lot of people, right?
For sure.
And but now, like, I enjoy that competition. Like I said, hey, if four people come to our game or if 40,000 people, I love competing and teaching it and coaching it. And, you know, and our guys, you know, I want to give our players – as much of that feeling of, yeah, we do it for competing, but also, you know, it's important to be out here competing. So, yeah, I was, like I said, I'm going to use this word a lot tonight. I was very blessed to grow up where I did, have the family that allowed me to, you know, my mom and dad didn't make me get a job, you know, when I was, you know, 14, 15, 16 growing. Now I baled hay and I did stuff like that, but I didn't have to have a job every day. I could go work at becoming a good basketball player. And I was very blessed to grow up with, you know, parents that allowed me to do that and a family that did, and teachers and coaches that allowed me to do that, which I'm very thankful for.
Yeah. That's sometimes I think we take that for granted. And I know, looking back at my own childhood, going through it in the moment, I didn't appreciate all those things, but my parents definitely smoothed the path for me to be able to do the things that I wanted to do in terms of becoming a basketball player. And I didn't have to work, and I got the things that I needed. And if I needed a ride here to this game or to that, you know, they were there to be able to provide that. And I think sometimes we take that for granted. You know, you need people along the way to help you, whether that's coaches, parents, friends, whatever, that make it easier for you to do the things that you want to do. So what's your best memory of high school basketball?
Ooh, man. I have a lot of good ones. One of them you mentioned, I really enjoyed coming out of the locker room with the group of guys that I've been together with since, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, and the whole town being there and competing, you know, and, you know, representing our high school and our town, et cetera. That's, you know, those memories are etched into your mind. I actually was able to go back. I haven't been back a lot, but I was able to go back and see the gym where we played, which they have a new gym now. But I went back, and a good friend of mine who has a daughter who's in junior high there, the gym is now the junior high gym. And she couldn't understand why I wanted to go back and look at the junior high gym. she didn't understand that. Why does Coach Jason want to go back and see the junior high gym? And it was the high school gym when I played. So that's what I wanted to do. Like, when I was back in town, I wanted to go in the locker room. I wanted to feel it one more time. Right. But as far as like best memory, obviously my senior year, we started off, I think, 15-0 maybe, and we were beating people pretty good. And it's as good a basketball as a team had played in a while at Warsaw. And, you know, the excitement that got generated around us and being able to do it with seven seniors, the guys that have worked really hard to be successful and been together and played a lot of two-on-two and three-on-three together. And it was a special time. And, I remember that a lot, right?
Yeah, those moments. It's funny because I think – a lot of times what we remember, and you remember specific games, and maybe you remember some big wins, or you remember a loss that, you know, hurt you. But what you tend to remember a lot is just those moments that kind of all blend together, where you were with your buddies, you were with your teammates, you were in the locker room, something that is more intangible than the wins and losses. And that's one of the things that I've always tried to keep in mind whenever I'm coaching, is that, you know, when your one loss record, obviously it's important, but also the feeling that you create around your team and your program, I think, is also something that the kids who play for you and who are part of what you're doing, those are the things that they're going to remember, those things off the floor. They're not going to remember every win and every loss 20 years from now, 30 years from now, but they're going to remember those sort of ancillary things that went along with, you know, being a part of the team. And it sounds like that's that special feeling that you had when you were at Warsaw obviously is still with you today as a, you know, as a 47-year-old.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about the relationships, right? We'll talk about that later on, too.
Yeah, no question.
Exactly what it's about.
Yeah, no question. All right, so at what point in your high school career does it start to become apparent that you're going to have a chance to continue to play college basketball? And did you always have that sort of in the back of your mind as you were growing up playing, that, hey, someday I'd like to play college basketball? Or was the Warsaw program so big in your eyes that you never really looked beyond that until you got right near the end and it seemed like you were going to play? So how would you describe your process of getting to college and being recruited?
Sure. Well, the when I was younger, obviously Jeff Gross went on to Northwestern, Rick Fox went on to North Carolina. We had other guys, Marty Lehman went to Ohio University. So you saw guys doing it. It was also a way for me to go to college, right? Like, it was a way for me to get my education paid for, you know, so I wanted to play. And I wanted to play Division I because, you know, I thought that was the end all be all at the time. And so I guess Rick Fox was a senior to be when I was rising freshman. So we had a lot of college coaches in the gym, obviously. And then, you know, as I went through my career, I thought, you know, hey, you know, maybe I could be, I never knew, maybe I could be a college player. I thought I was I would have that opportunity if I kept working. And then we went to a five-star basketball camp. Coach Rhodes and Mr. Garfinkel were close. Coach Rhodes had been taking people to a five-star basketball camp for years when I got there, a couple years before I got there. And then I started going really when I was a freshman. So I went to five-star basketball camp for 4 years. And that's where Matt Doherty from Davidson was working for Coach McKillop, saw me play. And started recruiting me, and that's really where my recruitment, and with Coach Roach's contacts, that's where my recruitment took off. And then I realized, like, hey, I think I'm going to be able to do this if I keep getting better, right? So that's when I really realized that, hey, this may be an opportunity for me to go to college and play Division I basketball.
So. All right, so let's run a tangent to five-star and just go back to that time and how important. I think people who are in the basketball world who are Coach Jason's age over here don't realize how important and impactful five-star was. And you look back and you see some of, you go on the five-star website or you see some of those old photos of the guys that went through there, and then the fact that they're playing on converted tennis courts with chain link fences around it. And, you know, I look back on that now, and I went to five-star between my junior and senior year, and that was the only year that I went. But you look back, and the guy that was there when I was there was Billy Owens, was the guy the week I was there from Carlisle. And you look at it now and you think about the way that the top players around the country play today, and they travel around, they're playing in great gyms, they got full uniforms. And then you look at those old photos, and again, here they are on these old hard tennis courts in the sun, you know, with, you know, their ratty t-shirts on and, you know, outdoor shoes. And it's just amazing that that's the way it was then compared to how it is now. It's just, it's kind of incredible. It's almost like you can't even imagine if the kids today who play the way they do. And it's like what we talked about before, the world has changed in the way that we do things. But I think if those kids who are 17, 18 years old, who are some of the elite high school players in the country, look back at what, you know, what it was like then, you know, I think they'd be kind of amazed.
Yeah, I think they would be amazed. Not only the players, the coaches, like
right,
the people
yeah.
who were actually coaching the kid. Like, so
it was incredible.
I actually went to Five Star, I believe, 4 times. And then I worked for Mr. Garfinkel for, shoot, I don't know, 7 years, maybe something like that. I worked all my college career. And then 2 years when I was teaching and coaching high school, I went back. I mean, so, you know, my last year, Five Star, Travis Best and Grant Hill were on one team. On my team was Pat Sullivan. Like, I have a picture of, like, Travis Best dribbling, Grant Hill setting the ball screen, me guarding, right? It's like one of those things, like, which one of these doesn't belong here, right? Like,
right.
I'm the guy that doesn't, like, these two guys are really good, right?
I That's
just
awesome.
Okay, right? And but we were in shirts and skins, and we were outside, and it was 9 o'clock at night, and it's hot, and it is, it was a special time, and but it's just different time now. I think also for coaches, like the coaches at Five Star, like you're trying to win, you're teaching, you're coaching your team for the week. It was a great learning environment for coaches. Like for assistant coaches now, assistant college coaches or high school coaches, I tell people all the time, what helped me in my career is working all these camps, right? So I'd have a team on Monday. And this is a little bit later in my career. Obviously, I was now a coach, but I'd have a team on Monday. If I didn't like that team, I had a new team next Monday, so it didn't matter. But I had a chance to work with this team for 4 days, 5 days, try to get them to defend, and you can work with them. And then they go home, and you can deal with personalities, and you can deal with, you know, how do you teach? And it was a training ground for being a coach. And I was fortunate enough to work Five Star many times and Grace College. Like I said, I worked that every year. My parents moved when I went to Davidson. So when I went back home, I worked Grace Camp for 8 weeks. I'd have 8 teams and then or 6 weeks, I'd have 6 teams. And I go to Five Star for 3 weeks and work 3 weeks camp. So I'd have 9 weeks of teams where I knew I wanted to be a coach, where you could just soak up and work on stuff. And now you see it. Coaches don't have that. Like, where do they do? Where can you coach a team, right? And where can you work on things like that? I don't know that. And I didn't see it at the time, but it's really helped me be a better coach. So going back to like outdoor stuff, if you're working there or playing there, it was like guys loved to play, right? They just love basketball. That's what it was. And you really had to love basketball. Not all the peripheral stuff, but you had to love basketball to do that, right? You ate horrible food for the week. You walked to the hills of Robert Morris College, right?
Yep.
Walking them down. And you're going to play on tennis courts. And, you know, if I could shoot it. Well, heck, I had to shoot out. If it was windy today, I was in trouble.
There goes my game, right? Yeah. Well, but in your defense, let's say this, that because you were used to playing outside, you were able to do that much more. Now, if you took a kid today,
sure,
put him out on an outdoor court and it's windy, they'd have no chance of taking a shot. So, at least you and I had some experience playing outside.
Good point.
So I've talked a few times in the podcast. I've been having the last 3 or 4 summers, we've been having a group that come together and we try to play on Saturday mornings. It's kind of dwindled at this point, but Saturday morning we play outside. Well, there was one day that it was really bad weather, but we found a gym we could use inside. And the first shot, I like airballed it, and I said, "Oh man, that wind picked up."
Yeah,
it picked up, and they all laughed because, of course, that was always our excuse when we didn't hit a good shot outside, and then we're playing inside. I like that excuse a lot.
You know,
missing out on outdoor basketball, I think, is something that, you know, kids today, I just don't think they play in that same way, where you go to a court and you can stay on for a couple hours, or you lose and you got to sit for an hour and a half. And that's something that I think kids today do miss out on. I think they're exposed to way better coaching in a lot of cases. And obviously you talked about it earlier with the number of games that kids get to play, which everybody likes to play. But I do think you miss out on that playing for two and a half hours, 3 hours straight just on the playground that you and I might have done back in the day.
Yeah, the other thing I think you miss out on, I kind of touched on it with my high school teammates, but like when we got together, we'd have to make teams. We'd have to get know the rules. We'd have to know, like, so there's nobody else, like, okay, what are we playing to? Well, what are the teams? Well, how are we making teams? Well, when you lose, who's on next? Like, so in my opinion, like, that part of it's your leadership skills, right? And your, how did you know that you weren't any good? Well, nobody picked you, so therefore you either got better, right, or you got better, so you worked at your game, or you took up the piano. Like, so, like, it was the coach didn't like me because there was no coach there, right? There was just guys at the playground, and they're picking guys, or we're shooting for who's on the team. And so that part of it is missing as well. Now, you can find it, like I said, you can find it different ways. But I do think there was a leadership. So growing up in high school, we had to, all right, how are we getting to this park to play? And then when are we getting there? We didn't have cell phones, so you had to.
Right, it took a lot more coordination back then.
You had carrier pigeons.
And if somebody wasn't there, you either wait for them. But, like, you couldn't call, hey, I'm 5 minutes away. Like, you just had to be patient and wait. Maybe somebody shows up, we play. Right. But that part of – now, some of that's good. Like, some of that technology stuff is great. Like, I love having my phone. I don't have to worry about directions. That's awesome. But some of that leadership ability – you know, I run camp at Emory for the day camp for kids. And I used to hate it. Like, we'd have free time for 30 minutes after, like, we played a game. And I hate it. I used to hate it because I wanted to structure everything. And then I started watching the kids – and they would actually pick teams and play or play knockout or do some in a gym. And I said, you know what? We're going to have 30 minutes of camp where you can do whatever you want with the basketball. Like, but you can pick the team. You can do that. Like, because kids don't get to do that anymore. And it's really the adults and us as coaches that have screwed that up.
Right? Yeah, it's so true. That free play just doesn't, you know, it doesn't exist. And I've said it before, too. I think a lot of it is the way we parent today too. Like, I know if I was growing up in today's society, the chances of me being able to be 13 or 14 years old and jump in my 16-year-old friend's car and drive 40 minutes across town to find a playground in a neighborhood that my mom or dad might not have wanted me in.
No, that's true.
That stuff, that just wouldn't happen today.
That's true.
And it's, you know, that makes it different too and harder on kids from that standpoint. So it's, again, it's different than it was back when we were playing, and you said it off the top. It's not better. It's not worse. It's just different. And obviously, you and I, being from the age bracket that we're from, you look back on your own memories fondly. And, you know, I sometimes feel bad for my own kids that they didn't get to experience it in the same way that I did. But they also have gotten to experience something that I didn't. So there's give and take in all, you know, in the whole thing.
Head Start Basketball's Cutthroat Game Building Program debuts on Tuesday nights in September. Players in grades 5 through 10, both boys and girls, you won't want to miss this one. Registration is open now at www.headstartbasketball.com.
All right, let's go to how you ended up at Davidson from Warsaw, Indiana. Obviously, the connection through five-star. But talk a little bit about how that came to be. And I know you mentioned earlier about how important it was at that time in your life to be able to play Division I basketball. So talk a little bit about the whole process for yourself.
Sure. So I got recruited throughout my senior year. We had a good senior year and got offered scholarships a couple places. And honestly, you know, Davidson wasn't the Davidson it is now, right? Coach McKillop wasn't Coach McKillop that he is now. He was just at Davidson in 89-90. That was my senior year of high school. We were really his first full recruiting class. Matt Doherty saw me play at five-star. I joke with Coach McKillop a lot now that I was a guy at the spring semester. Hey, we need another guy. Let's take this kid, you know. And, I was that guy, right? And my class that went in there, well, and I believed in – like Coach McKillop's vision, and you know, he was a high school coach before he came to Davidson. But there was something about Davidson when I stepped on campus and Coach McKillop that I felt at home. And there are schools closer to
my home in Indiana or in Ohio, where my parents moved, that I that were close to recruiting me, but I felt at home when I went to Davidson. Now, you asked me why I picked Davidson. They were 4-24 that year, so I have no idea. Looking back, but I said this before. I've just always been a big believer in leaving something better than when you first got there, right? And a builder. And Coach McKillop had that vision. Like, he had a vision for Davidson basketball. Davidson basketball had a great tradition with Lefty and, you know, those teams in the late 60s, which to me, you know, that's like, you know, now kids think the 90s is the Stone Age. I think 69 was the Stone Age, right? Like, just, but, you know, there was Coach McKillop, Coach Doherty, Coach Hogan recruited me. And went there, decided, hey, I want to go play for Coach McKillop. Again, blessed. I didn't know it at the time, the world didn't know how good a basketball coach Bob McKillop is. And I'll say this, how good a teacher Bob McKillop is. But I feel like I've been, Al Rhodes and Bob McKillop are two of the best teachers in the world. And then they teach basketball, but they're also two of the best teachers that you could possibly have growing up, especially if you want to be a coach or if you want to be a teacher. Like, they're two guys that I've just been very blessed to be around. Now, I use the word blessed, but it's not like somebody just handed it to us or me, you know, like I had to work very hard to have that opportunity. But I was a little fortunate and lucky that I made that choice, you know, and I'm thankful for it every day.
Well, you got the opportunity to work and learn and play under two guys that obviously have had a huge influence on you and that have proven their success over the long term of being great teachers and being great coaches. And I think that, you know, you look back on any person's story who's been successful, and there are guys like that or women like that in their lives who have had that kind of impact on them and have gotten them and helped them get to where they are today. And you mentioned earlier about how important those relationships are. And, you know, they're important when you're on the playing side of it and your relationship with your coach. And then conversely, now as a coach, I'm sure your relationships with your players. And I even think about when you were talking about five-star back a minute ago, and you were mentioning how good it is for coaches to have all the opportunity to learn and to coach. But think about, I'm sure, the relationships that you were able to build there as a coach and some of the other coaches who were there coaching as part of the staff, and just how important all of that was in your ultimate development as a coach. Let's think about when you first got to Davidson. What do you feel like was the biggest adjustment going from high school to college, maybe both on and off the court?
Yeah, well, obviously you grow up, you want to be, I grew up and want to be a Division I player. One of the biggest adjustments was the first game you go into, you run out, there's not 3,200 people there at Davidson at the time. Right.
And
so you spend your whole life wanting to be this Division I basketball player, and you have these visions of being a Division I basketball player, of, you know, playing at Indiana, or et cetera, you're growing up in Indiana, right? Well, when you, now I'm a Division I basketball player at Davidson, I run out and they hadn't been successful at the time. And hey, this is different now, right? And so you have to realize, like, you got Coach McKillop on your tail for 2 hours a day or more, or 3 hours a day. And now you're playing and we're working, we're struggling to be successful. And there's pressure there, and you're at a really strenuous academic institution where you have to work at it academically. And so there are times when you say, man, is this really what I dreamed of? Right.
Right.
And,
right.
And then you realize that it's exactly what you dreamed of, because you're getting a great education, you're playing for a great coach, and you're building something that now, when I look at Davidson basketball, it's surreal to me. Like, Steph Curry, and they go to the Elite Eight, and they've been to the tournament X amount of times. They're in the Atlantic 10. Bob McKillop was one of the best coaches. Now everybody recognizes him as one of the best teachers in the country, right? But back then, hey, he was trying to save his job. I was just trying to play. We were just trying to win a game, right? And so that adjustment, there was pressure at Warsaw, Indiana, right? So the pressure when I went to Davidson, that wasn't as that big of a change for me, because I still felt like I was letting people down if we didn't play well. And I'd felt like that since I was 14 years old, right? So for some people, that's a big deal, right? For me, there was pressure. I wanted to be good, but it wasn't as drastic a change. But the intensity level, like Coach McKillop's personality, the academic piece, being away from home, you know, not having guys who were with you for 10 years that you're working with, like, hey, I just met these guys 2 months ago and we're trying to be successful here, right? And that's really helped me as a coach go through that process, right? Because now I know what guys are going through and I can talk them through that. And then, of course, as a player at Davidson, you know, we just continued to get better. And I think we won 10 games and 11 games and then 14. We were 500 my junior year, 14-14. And then we were 22-8, went to NIT, beat North Carolina State, Charlotte twice, Clemson my senior year. And, you know, it really started the foundation for what coaches has done now and a lot of the guys have done now, which is pretty special to sit back and watch. You know, you want to talk about building, like there's no better builder in college basketball than that guy. So.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think it's funny because I feel like our stories – parallel in a lot of ways. And I loved what you said when you said the word surreal, that you look at the program at Davidson where it is now and you think about the program that you entered into when you were a freshman. And obviously Coach McKillop was there and he's been the key component to making that happen. But at the time, like you said, they were coming off a 4-win season and you know there wasn't a track record of success, and now you're playing in this program and by the time you're a senior, you get it to the NIT. But the idea that, you know, one of the best two or three players in the NBA was someday going to be a Davidson, you know, a Davidson alum. I'm sure that was not on your radar when, you know, when you were playing there. And I played at Kent. And while we were there, we went to the NIT twice during my 4 years. So we had some good teams. But then in 2002, Kent State goes to, you know, the Elite Eight, loses to That's Indiana. Right. And, you know, I looked at that and I thought about the program that I played in. And then I thought about the program that they became when they went to the Elite Eight and arguably probably, I think if they played Indiana 10 times, they might have won 7 of them. Just had a bad shooting night and didn't play well. So I couldn't fathom that the program that I played in would have ever been able to get to the level that they've been able to get. And, of course, they've run off a ton of 20-win seasons in a row. And so I look at that program and I compare it to the one that I came into. And just as a point of reference, my freshman year, our shorts had zippers on them. So so the program obviously has progressed quite a bit from that from those days when I started. So, but it's fun to be able to go back and see the success that they've had. And I'm sure for you, it's fun to – being a Davidson alum probably means a lot more now than it did, you know, to guys who graduated prior to you.
I remind people a lot, like, hey, Davidson's been good before Steph now, and Davidson's been good after Steph, but absolutely Steph Curry did go to Davidson College, right? Like, that's what's great. Like, you know, Lefty in the late 60s, you know, Davidson was ranked number one in the country for a while. They were phenomenal, right? Then we have some down years, and then now Coach McKillop's got it back, But yeah, if everybody asked me a question on a plane or at the airport or somewhere, hey, where'd you go to school? I went to Davidson. Oh, isn't that where Steph Curry went? That's the first thing.
Right.
Yes, Steph did go there, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
I love it, right? Like, it's just to be able for Steph and the kind of person Steph is to be able to do that for Davidson is just, it's really, like I said, it's surreal. It's great.
Yeah. And I think he does the same thing for his high school, because we had a chance to talk to Sean Brown on the show. Yes. And he said basically the same thing about Steph. And so, you know, it seems like wherever he's gone, he's left a legacy of goodwill with all the people that he's been able to touch, and everything that you hear is that that's just the kind of guy he is. So credit to him as a guy who's made it to the highest level and is still, you know, loyal and a part of the, you know, when he wasn't a huge name. You know, and he was part of those programs and still is, you know, supporting them and is the kind of guy that you want to have associated with what you do. So at what point do you, do you know that coaching is the direction that you want to go whenever your playing career is finished? Do you know that early on, or were you, or did it come when you were in college? Or at what point did you say, hey, I know whenever my playing days are done that I want to get into coaching?
Yeah, so my summer jobs were always working camps, basketball camps, partly because I wanted to work out and still be around the game, partly because I wanted to go back home a little bit because I could work back in Warsaw, right on the lake, where I could get back there for 5 or 6 weeks to see high school buddies and work out. And so, you know, that was my summer job. And you go to Davidson, you don't go to Davidson to become necessarily a basketball coach or a teacher, right? Or the same thing like Emory. You don't come to Emory if you want to be thinking about being a – but I – that has been my calling, I think, from, I don't know if you call it that, but it's just been something that's been, hey, I enjoy it, right? It's not work for me. It's something that I enjoyed the competition. I was decent at it. So, as I went through Davidson, it was either being an accountant or being a basketball coach, and I just can't be. I couldn't sit behind a desk and make numbers, right? So, hey, man, I'm going to be a basketball coach, right? But I actually, my first job out of Davidson was at Greensboro Day School. And Greensboro Day School in North Carolina, Freddie Johnson is a legendary coach in North Carolina, high school coach. And I interviewed for an economics and government teaching job, and I walked to the gym and said, hey, if I get this job, I'd love to coach. And he was like, of course, you're going to coach the freshman team, and you got the job. So it's good. And so I coached a freshman team and assistant varsity. And then the second year, I was the head JV coach and assistant varsity. We won 2 state championships in the varsity. We coached guys like Justin Gainey, Aaron McMillan, DJ McDuffie, a bunch of Division I guys on our team. And then Coach McKill called me and asked me to come back and gave me a 3-quarter pay cut. So it was great. paid me about a quarter of what I was making teaching to be a college basketball coach. And of course, the day he called me, I packed my bags and left.
That's funny.
But I think teaching really allows you to be a better coach. You know, I dealt with, in the classroom, you deal with 30 kids or, you know, maybe 15, 20 kids at our private school. But you deal with kids who don't want to be there, don't want to learn economics and government. Well, you got to figure out how to teach them, right? And you got to be aware of the room and how, you know, this person's not, you know, had a bad day today. And dealing with young people and teaching allowed you to deal with my team. And it was great practice for dealing with our teams now. And so those 2 years I wouldn't change for anything before I got into college coaching and met my wife in Greensboro. So I definitely wouldn't change that. And then I went back to Davidson for 7 years. You find out a lot of things as a coach that you didn't know as a player, right? Like all the work that they were putting in and, you know, to practice or to games and all, you know, you find out how everything's done, right? And sometimes as a player, you don't want your players to see that sometimes because you just want them focused on, hey, here's how we guard, here's what we do. And you don't have to see all the stuff that goes into it. But working for Coach McKillop was you know, you're in a clinic every day with Coach, and it was a special time.
So what's the most surprising thing? Because I always think that's really interesting, and obviously in your situation, you got an opportunity to go back and work for the same coach that you had previously played for. So you saw it from a player perspective, and now you get a chance to go back and be a part of the staff and see it from the coach perspective. So what was the most surprising thing to you about what coaches did that as a player you had no idea what was going on behind the scenes? What were one or two things you're like, man, I didn't realize that they spent as much time doing this, or I didn't even know that they had to do that? What were some of those things that opened your eyes when you first became a part of the coaching staff as opposed to seeing it from the player side?
Yeah, well, first off is just how little has to do with actually X and O's in basketball, right?
Like, right.
I mean, hey, man, we spend 10% of our time on basketball. 90% of our time is spent on whatever, you know, else, recruiting or, you know, class stuff, academics, weights, conditioning. At the time, we didn't have, like, you could have a 4-man workout at a time. That was it. So you were basketball, like some guys were, like I did all the individual instruction stuff when I first got back there. That was my job. But then, you know, just little things like, oh, I didn't know that's how the food got on the bus. I just thought I got on the bus and there was food on the bus.
The food fairy put it there?
That's it. The magic wand. It was all there.
Yeah. You had to order that. You had to get that. You had to figure out what you want to eat, how, you know. And I tell my staff now, I was like, I don't want our guys knowing. Now, I want them to be grateful and I want them to be thankful and all that. But I don't want them worried about how the food got on the bus. Like, I want them worried about how we're going to stop whoever from scoring. Right. Or how we're going to score. Right. How we're going to, you know, what's your job? And but that's the biggest thing I say. How little is actually, hey, let's run this offense or hey, let's run this defense. It's more of, hey, how do we get this young man better and how do we get him in a state of mind to be able to make a shot? Right. How do we get him? And the X and O is like actually what we're going to run is really minor. Now it becomes major, but for most of the year, that's really minor stuff, right?
Absolutely. I think it's just – it's so interesting because as a player, you have no concept of the amount of time. I know when I was playing, you know, you just think, well, the coach shows up a half hour before practice and, you know, they're kind of sitting in their office and maybe, you know, I come in and in between classes to say hello or ask a question and – no, they're not really doing a whole lot except during the time for practice. And, yeah, they got to travel to the games with us on the bus and they're away from their family. But you don't really think about all those things that once you see it from the coaching side, that all those things that go on. Let me ask you this. While you were there at Davidson as an assistant, what were some things that you learned that maybe if somebody's out there who's listening, who's just getting into coaching and they're going to go and get their first assistant coaching job, what are some things that you would say that you've learned over the course of your career that someone who's going to be an assistant coach, what tips would you have for them to be a good assistant coach? What do you look for now as a head coach? And what did you learn when you were an assistant to try to make your head coach's job easier?
Yeah, I think I'd be a much better assistant coach today than I was then. Let's put it that way. Like just because of all experience I went, you know, I've been through now, but you know, back then you had this sense of how important you are, right? When like, hey, this is my scout, whatever it may be. Hey, this is, you know, what I'm doing for the team. And I tell my guys when I hire guys, I say, I'm not hiring you to make my job easier. I'm hiring you to make our players better in whatever way, as people, as students, as basketball players, et cetera. However, your job is to make my job, like take things off my plate, right? So like if you're an assistant coach, a good assistant coach knows what to take off coach's plate, right? Coach probably doesn't need to know what offense to run, right? Coach probably doesn't need a new quick hitter to run. Coach right. needs to make sure that, hey, his best player, especially at Division I, his best player is getting pass a class, right? His best player like is getting things done in the classroom he has to do, whether that be study hall monitoring or professors is staying up with, hey, are you making your meetings with your professors, et cetera. Hey, are you eating right? Are you ready to go? Like that kind of stuff where you can take off the head coach's plate is so vital. And I didn't, you know, as a 24-year-old, I didn't see that as I do now. Right. And being able to, and also being able to know what's important for the head coach to know, like, hey, this is, you know, you can't take everything off his plate. Some things he has to know about, right?
So, right.
You know, when's the right time to tell him, right? When's the right time to take care of it, right? Like, hey, I'm going to go, you know, coach is on the road. I'm going to make sure when he comes back, everything is running smooth, right? And that's what my job is. Or, you know, if your job is film exchange, which it not anymore because that
right.
we have synergy, but
a little bit easier, a little bit easier today, right?
Yeah. I could get on that soapbox, right? My dad's laughing at me when I get on that, but, but I think that's important. And also, we said this, you know, people ask, well, why did you get better at Davidson? And why did Davidson turn the corner? And I've said this all along. Well, my freshman year, if you walked into the locker room and said, you know what, Coach McKillop's crazy, he lost his mind. You may have 10 guys saying, you're right, coach has lost his mind. Four guys saying nothing. And one guy be like, no, you know what? Get out of the locker room. You're crazy, right? By my senior year, you had 10 guys, same thing happened. 10 guys saying, hey, get out of the locker room. Don't talk about coach like that. Four guys are still saying nothing. And one guy is saying, you're right, he is crazy because that guy ain't playing anyway, right?
Right.
But that belief is what makes teams great, right? Not what play you run, but that belief is what got us over the top to be better and to win games. Well, you have to have that with your staff too. Now, your staff is a little different because you have to have guys that challenge you, right? But you have to know when to challenge. Like, you can't challenge everything your head coach says, right? You can't, like, because they'll tune you out. But right. There's certain times when you can challenge. There's other times when you need to say, hey, you're right, coach. We'll get it done, right? And that's a skill, and that's all relationship stuff. That has nothing to do with coaching. That has to do with, like, relationships and being able to read and be aware of the room and be aware of, you know, personalities and psychology kind of stuff. And I guess that's a long answer to the question, but that's what I'd say is, what can you do to help the program, right? And that's something that's challenging for young coaches. I think it's challenging for me is when I first got there, I was so used to Coach McKill tell me what to do. Like when I was a player, okay, you right. do this, you get better, you do this, you get better, you do this. And now when you become an assistant coach, there's not somebody telling you what to do all the time. You have to find ways. Okay, how can I help the program? In what way do I help the program? The head coach doesn't have time to tell you every day what to do. Like, you have to be a self-starter and understand those things. And that's challenging sometimes for guys who've been, you know, hey, what did coach tell me to do? That's what I'm going to do, right?
So, yeah, I think that's really true. And especially coming from being a guy who was a player to where there was that player coach relationship and obviously a divide in terms of, you know, I listen to what my coach says, and now suddenly you're more on the peer level with that same coach. And I'm sure in the back of your mind, there's still a part of you, regardless of how long you were on that staff, you still looked at him as your coach to some degree, as opposed to necessarily, you know, your colleague. I'm sure there was still a part of you that remembered what it was like when you were a player. And so I think that mentality, when you're back with your own program and with your guy that you were, you know, that you played under, I'm sure that was a factor too. So you eventually make your way to Evansville as an assistant. So talk about how you ended up there and sure. what the process was like for leaving Davidson and going to Evansville.
Yeah. You know, it was a time when, Coach Matheny, Matt Matheny, one of my best friends, was there at Davidson still. I was there. Jim Fox was there. We had a great staff, and I felt like it was time for me to make a move, right? I don't know what move, you know, like you make, you just never know. So it was a time for me, hey, this is a time I could go back to Indiana. My wife actually was from Evansville, which is craziness. But I knew Evansville growing up. Jim Cruz, I knew the Purple Aces. Like there was a familiarity with me with Evansville. I didn't know much about the university. I got to meet Steve Merfeld. Obviously, Steve had done a great job at Hampton. I could get in the Missouri Valley, which at the time, the Missouri Valley was a monster. The 4 years I was at Evansville, it was ridiculous, the amount of good teams in the Missouri Valley. So I thought it was a good time and also for me professionally, I played for coach for 4 years. I worked with him for 7 years. Like, there was a time for me, I had an itch to, like, hey, is this the only way to do stuff? I want to go out there and see, hey, there may be other ways. And I thought it was a good chance for that, right? I've been at Davidson for 7 years. And I was still young enough that I could go, you know, experience some other things, right? So I made that jump, and then 4 years at Evansville were a tremendous time of my life. I had two kids in Evansville. I had my son and daughter were born in Evansville. We didn't win as many games as we would have liked, obviously, and the league was brutal. And but we got better in the 4 years we were there. I got better as a coach in the 4 years we were there. And I really learned a lot. I learned a lot about how Steve did things compared to how coach did things. And I was on staff with some great coaches. Kareem Richardson was who just was at UMKC, just got let go this year. Sean O'Regan was on staff with me. He's a head coach at JMU women's team now, doing a great job. Steve's at Creighton. But I just learned so much in those 4 years. And our athletic director, Bill McGillis, who's still a good friend, he's out in San Diego now. I got to meet some people who are different from my Davidson family, right? And, you know, it didn't end the way we wanted to, obviously. But being in the Missouri Valley and coaching against, at the time, was, you know, Creighton, Wichita State, Southern Illinois was great back then. Barry Henson was at Southwest Missouri. They were phenomenal back then. Bradley went to the Sweet 16. Jim Les was coaching them. Mark Turgeon was at Wichita State at the time. Creighton had Dana Altman. Like, it was an unbelievable learning experience for me as a coach. And also outside my comfort zone of Davidson and what we did, which forced you to just, you know, be a sponge every day. So, yeah, it was a great experience for me as a coach as well.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense that you've been under one system. I always said that one of the things that I would have loved to have done, and I thought of it more from a player perspective than a coach perspective, but it kind of goes to what you said, is that, you know, I would have loved when I was playing to go and, you know, sit in on a practice, you know, some of the schools that we played against, just to see what their practices looked like and what their, you know, what their training table looked like and what their travel looked like, just to see how it compared to the way we were doing things. And I think that that's kind of what you're describing, is that you had sort of seen the Davidson way, the Coach McKillop way, and now you want to go and experience something else and see how somebody else puts things together. And I'm sure that was a period for you of tremendous growth, like you described. So how does the opportunity to get the head job at Emory come across your desk? How does being a Division I assistant in Evansville, Indiana, translate to a head coaching job at a Division III school in Atlanta, Georgia? How does that come to be?
Yeah, well, it's all relationships, right? We talk about it. Like, and I'll tell you this: how does anybody get a job nowadays? I have no idea, right? Like, I mean, like, I look back and say, how did I get this job? I have no idea, right? Now, I think I work very hard, and I think we've been successful. I'm glad I have it. I'm very fortunate. But the athletic director at Emory knew the athletic director at Davidson, who gave her my name. She knew the athletic director at Evansville. She called him, and then she ended up on the phone with me and asked if I was interested. And I said, I have no idea, because I don't know anything about it. And so I said, it was actually when Davidson was playing Maryland in the NCAA tournament, Steph's freshman year. And so it was right after that game, I said, Betsy, I don't know. Give me a second. I'll give you a call back. 45 seconds later, I called her back, said, I'm very interested. Right. It just, I pulled up the website. I read about it. I call a couple friends, like, that know Division III, that know schools, that know basketball. And it just fit me. Now, I say it fit me, but, and this is, again, the world today, like, sometimes Division III athletic directors look at Division I coaches and say, well, they're not good fits.
Right.
Or sometimes Division I athletic directors look at Division III coaches and say, well, they're not good fits. Well, but if you look at my background of Davidson and the way we recruited at Davidson, I'm a perfect fit for the way we can recruit at Emory and the kind of kid we can get. And, you know, just the background fits really well, but unless you do your research, that doesn't happen, right?
It doesn't, like, jump off the page at you necessarily.
It doesn't jump off the page at you. And unfortunately, I know there are a couple of other guys that, you know, a lot of guys in, you know, interviewed for the job or, like, put their resumes in. And like I said, how I got the job, I have no idea, but very, very blessed that I was given the opportunity. And, you know, I had an option. I had a couple options: to be a Division I assistant coach or the head coach at Emory. And I really want to be a head coach. And so I chose Emory, and kind of very naive about it. But I said, hey, I think we could be really good at Emory. I think it fits my background. It fits kind of what I believe in. Great education, great place to live, unbelievable level of basketball at our level, the UAA, the league we're in, And so I jumped when she offered me the job. It took me about 2 seconds to say, I'll take it. So
that's awesome. So if we think about the beginning of this, two questions for you. One, what was your biggest adjustment going from being a longtime assistant coach to taking over a program and being a head coach? And then to go along with that same line of questioning, what was your biggest adjustment from the Division I level to the Division III level?
Yeah. Being a head coach, you're, and I think this is a common phrase out there, your thoughts are no longer suggestions, they're actual decisions, right? Like,
right.
So it's not just a suggestion, you have to make a decision, right? And it's on you, like you're making that decision. That's a big deal. And then, you know, when you're the assistant coach and I want to do certain things that, hey, we should do this, we should. Okay. But then how do you go about putting that into practice? Right. It's not just theory. It's actually practice.
Right.
In theory, this is what we want to do. Okay. Well, how do you do that? Right. Well, I want to play like this. I want to run this offense. Well, how do we put that into play? Well, I want my guys to come to practice like this. And when you're at Davidson and you've been there for so long, that is a given. Like how they practice, how hard they practice, how they come to practice. That's you don't have to teach that stuff.
That's already been systematized.
Yeah, it's established. Now your first day of practice, we want to go from drill to drill, and you're like, man, I got to teach how we huddle. I got to teach how we line up. I got to teach how our terminology. There's so much to teach, and then being able to pick and choose what's important is incredible. It's a lot of stress, right? And you just have to keep, you know, taking small bites, and hopefully at some time you get to eat a meal, but you just keep chipping away at it. And then from Division One to Division Three, there was nothing, like zero. I don't ever walk down on the court and say, hey guys, we're Division Three, we're going to take it easy today.
Right.
Like,
right. Absolutely.
It's just not like, it's not in my, I know I've seen good coaches, right? I've seen great high school coach. I've seen a great college coach. I've been around great coaches. I know what great coaches do. I can kind of emulate them, right? And make sure that, hey, this is good basketball. I know what I've been through it. I know, hey, I'm going to try to do what they do, right? It doesn't matter if I'm a CYO coach or if I'm Division III coach or if I'm coaching the Warriors. Like this is now, obviously there's things that are important for us at Emory, right? Like these kids, they take classes that I can't spell, right? So I you know, we got to be aware of that, right? Yeah, obviously you're aware of that, but basketball piece of it, hey, basketball is basketball. If I'm teaching a 6-year-old in my camp, or if I'm teaching my guys, basketball is basketball. Now, obviously I'm going to be more advanced, but you know, we know how good basketball is. So from the Division III to Division I thing it wasn't that big of a transition to me. Now, recruiting wise, we're still recruiting great students who can make it at Emory, who can play at a high level. And, you know, okay, they maybe not play at Duke, but they can play at a high level for us, right? And in Division III level, or, you know, there are guys that, we can recruit guys at Emory that want to come to Emory, that have Division I options that want to come to Emory. Now, I said this when I was a player, I wanted to be a Division I player. I had no idea about the high-level Division III schools, right? I just didn't know.
Right. I agree with you.
Now I'm here and I'm in the UAA. I'm flying to Cleveland. I'm flying to Pittsburgh. I'm flying to Chicago. I'm flying to St. Louis, New York, Boston, Rochester. Every year I'm making these trips, right? Every year. Every year we're playing against these teams. Every year great players in our league. Like our basketball experience, our student experience, and where we get to live, our social experience, like I'll put it up against any in the country. And I didn't know that. Like as a coach, I got fortunate to fall into this situation of like I knew it was good, but I didn't know – like the experience of our players, what the experience that they can have. I say this all the time. When I was at Davidson, I didn't travel like we travel here. Now they do when they're in the Atlantic 10. But when we're in the Big South or the Southern Conference, like, hey, man, I'm on a bus.
You're getting a bus, right? Yeah, yeah, exactly. I wanted to ask you, that's one of the things that strikes me as super interesting about your league is talk to me a little bit about the travel and how you balance that travel with the academic rigor at your school.
Well, when I first got the job, I said, this is going to be impossible. Like, how do we do this? Like, you know, I got to travel all these places. And I'll be the first to tell you, like, it's exciting, it's fun, but it is hard, right? And it is challenging. By February, late February, you're done. Like, you're tired. You're fighting through, and it's a challenge, but it's exciting. The UAA is set up for students to be successful because of how we have like-minded institutions who all are very difficult and challenging. And so our travel schedule is set up. So basically we miss Fridays, Thursday afternoon and Fridays. And we do that three times. And then we miss another Friday, the fourth time. Now, a couple of those trips could be during holiday break. So school's not in session. So like last year, we had two road trips before school was in session. So we only had two road trips when school was in session. We only missed Thursday afternoon and Friday. And then Thursday afternoon and Friday again. So we missed like, what, two, almost three total days in the second semester to take all those trips. You know, we play on Friday night. So we travel on Thursday. We play Friday night. We travel to the next city on Saturday. We play Sunday afternoon. We fly home Sunday night. We're in class on Monday. And it's really a genius that put it all together, that this idea of we can have this league with like-minded institutions who can do this, that geography. We were like the Power Five conferences all over the country before they were.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Traveling big time.
Yeah. Now we don't charter. Now we have to. We're getting on Delta or Southwest.
I understand. Hey, you're still going. You're still going to big cities. You're going to great destinations. Yeah. And getting your kids exposure to that is tremendous.
It's a special league, and I tell you what else makes the league special are the kind of guys we have, the coaches we have in the league, right? And the coaches and the kind of people they are as well. So.
Yeah, for sure. We had the opportunity to have Coach McGinnis on from Case and
everybody but Todd.
Well, I was gonna,
everybody.
I was gonna say, you know, I was just looking at your schedule. I see you play in Cleveland on February 23rd. Cleveland might not exist if the Browns win the Super Bowl. Just so you know.
We'll be the aftermath of that. That's okay.
That's it. Coach Jason's a little bit more optimistic, I think, than your average Cleveland Browns.
No, I'm not saying they're going to win the Super Bowl.
He's counting some chickens over here.
No. Hold on. I don't think they're Super Bowl, but I'm just, if it was to happen, I'm just telling you, you might not have a game that day.
I may have to come up early. That's all.
Yeah, you might have to be part of the parade. Who knows?
That's right.
All right. So when you first take over the program, and obviously you've gotten to the point now where you have a certain style of play that you like, guys like to get up and down the floor and get a lot of threes up. At what point do you know right from day one when you stepped in there that that's the way we're going to play? Did you always want to play an up-tempo game? How did it sort of evolve to where you've gotten to your system the way you guys play today?
Yes, I had an idea of how we wanted to play, especially offensively, with running a secondary break and playing fast. And that's like my base. That's our base, right? I think in coaching, there's so much you can teach. You have to have a base, right? They have to have, whether it's your philosophy of offense or defense, or maybe it's your culture base, but there has to be a base that you teach. So that way your seniors know, like, so I'm here 2, 3, 4 years. If you keep changing every year, your seniors don't know what your base is. I think there has to be a base to your program. Part of our base is our philosophy and our code and things that we do that aren't basketball. But part of it is our offensive system, right? And I knew that I wanted it to be fast. So the first year we did things, and we just did them because I told them to do them. They didn't really know why, right? So they just ran fast, and they knew we wanted to play fast, and we just kind of threw it at the rim and hope it went in. But they played really fast. I had a great group of guys. We lost 9 games in a row at the end of the season, and in the 9th game, they were still playing their tails off. Like, they're competing. They were just they were tremendous men, young men, that really listened and tried to do what we asked them to do. So I knew we wanted to play that way. Probably wasn't the best way for my first team here to play.
Right. Right. Understood.
But I knew we were going to play that way, and I knew we had time to build a little bit. So, hey, we're going to set the tone. We're going to play this way. The second year, we slowed down a little bit, and then the third year, since the third year, we've been speeding up, in the range of where we're playing really fast. This year, we played as fast as we ever have. But and then that goes with players, too. We had really good offensive players this year. So, yeah, offensively, we knew we wanted to play fast. Defensively, we've changed a little bit throughout the 12 years here. And offensively, we've been flexible. We've tweaked it a little bit, but there's been a base to what we do for sure in the last 12 years.
So one of the things that I loved when you talked down at the Jay Billis camp this year, and as soon as you said it, I wrote it down because I'd never heard anybody say it quite this way. And I think it's something that coaches out there who are maybe trying to teach their guys to get up and down the floor. And you said, we teach our players not to run the lanes, but to race the lanes. So talk a little bit about that terminology and why it's so important and how it helps your team to really push the kind of pace that you're trying to get them to play at.
Yeah, I think the words that you use are very important, right? And they can paint a picture. It can create a narrative. And when you say run, well, everybody kind of knows run. Like, okay, I am running, coach. Like, or you say sprint. Coach, that is my sprint. Okay, fine. But when you say, hey, we're going to race, like we're racing the other team. Well, now that gives it even a greater emphasis on running the court, right? And it's just, it's a little thing, but it's important to maybe get across how fast we want to run, right? And so, I think Coach McKillop is great at that. He really prepares, and he prepares way more than most coaches, what words he wants to use to describe these things and teach these things. And it's something that I stole from him, probably. It was just, hey, we race, right? We convert, our first two steps are important, but we want to race the court. And I think it paints a different picture than just saying, hey, let's run hard, right? Those are just little things that I think coaches coach for 40 years. I've been able to coach for maybe 50, and I've coached for, now probably 25, 30. And those are just things that as you go around, hey, that worked. Let's use that verbiage, right? Let's use that terminology. And every kid, if I ask a 6-year-old, hey, we're going to race to the other end, he knows what that means, right?
Absolutely.
I'm trying to beat you, right? I'm trying to beat you. That's what I'm trying to do. So I think I think when I was speaking at Jay Bill's camp, like I had told another coach there, Coach Schulman, about that, and I had forgotten it, and he reminded me about that, right? So it's just one of those things that as we teach, we go about and teach those things that I think can make a difference, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a concept that, any basketball coach who's probably coached from the fourth grade level and above has at some point probably said to their kids, hey, run the lanes. And, I've been around the game for 40 years and I never heard anybody ever say race the lanes. And as soon as you said it, like I said, it made a ton of sense to me of how that could paint a different picture for any player that I'm trying to coach as I'm trying to get them to get down the court and, get set up or get into our offense or whatever it is that we're going to do from that position, rather than just saying run by saying raced. I'm making a much clearer picture in that player's mind of what it is that I want him to do. And what I heard you say there, as you kind of explained where it came from, was a word that I've used before on the podcast, and that's being intentional. So how much more intentional are you today after having been at Emory for 10 years or so than you were in your first year with your language and your relationship building and some of the things that when you go into a practice, how much are you thinking about those teachable moments or your language or your relationships maybe than you were that first year when you had your very first team?
Yeah, I think that continues to grow, right? Like, so you just build on it over through the years, right? So you have all your practice plans and your notes from your practice plans. And hey, that was really good. Like, I'll look back at notes that we've had from 5 years ago teaching something in practice. Like, oh, that was really, we need to come back to that.
Right. Like, yeah.
We need to do that again. Right. And I think when you go through those experiences, again, it's not just theory. Well, when I become a head coach, I'm going to do this. Well, now I've done that. And you know what? That stuff doesn't work. Now I'm going to do this. Right. Like, and so, now you just have so many experiences that you have, how many practices you've been in where, hey, I've done that. That didn't work. Let's try this. Let's explain it this way. Let's have build this relationship. Let's work on. So being able to be at Emory for 12 years really allows you to you know, be a teacher and become a better teacher every day. And that's something that, again, you know, you've been when you're around. You know, Coach McKillop's done that for how many years, right? Like at Davidson, 30 years, right? And every practice, I mean, we sit down and talk about how we're going to talk about this drill. And sometimes as an assistant coach, you go, Coach, I played here. I've been here for 7 years. Like, do we really have to talk about this drill? Yeah, we do. And we're going to talk about this drill and how we teach it and how what we say here and what we're going to look for. So I think that just, it grows as you're there and you want to get better, right? And one of the things that we say, I've used a lot this summer, is I think one of the biggest hurdles to greatness is boredom, right? Like a kid gets bored by shooting. Well, the only way you become a good shooter is you go shoot, right?
Right.
But now there's so many other things. If they get bored, well, I can go do this. So, okay, I can go do this. I can go do that. I'm bored, so I'm just not going to do this anymore. Well, hey, to be a great basketball player, it's going to be boring. Like, you have to learn how to do these. You have to do them over and over and over again. And it's going to be, there's going to be some boredom set in there. So don't let that be a hurdle for you. I think as a coach, it's the same thing. Like, hey, if you get bored with teaching what you do well, you're going to have a problem. You're not going to be as good this year as you were last year because you didn't teach it as well. And so I think every year, you know, we say, well, my guys know that. Okay. But can I use a different term, or can I explain it a little bit better? Or heck, can we just drill it better? Can we just get more reps? Right. And I think you can constantly work at getting better like that for sure.
So that takes us back to the beginning of the podcast where we talked about you out in the barn or in the cornfield or me on the driveway taking shots, and the fact that, you know, I was willing to stand out there for an hour, 2 hours, whatever, by myself
in the rain.
Yeah, in the rain, in the snow, whatever, working on my game. And a lot of people would have thought that was boring. You know, there's a lot of people that would have said, I don't want to do that. And now, like we've also talked about, the kids have an anti-boredom machine right there in their pocket.
That's
and,
right.
You know, it's easy to just pull out the phone and be entertained and not put in the hour or the 2 hours or whatever it is working on shooting or working on your skills. And so I think you're 100% right that being able to fight through that boredom and that monotony is what it really takes to get really, really good at anything that you do. Let me ask you this. I want to talk a little bit about, because it's been another theme that's kind of run through everything that we've talked about, and that's relationships. Can you talk a little bit about what you do on a day-to-day basis to build relationships with your players, to build the kind of trust that you need in order to be able to push them to be at their best as a member of your team?
Yeah, I think it's vital that you're present. Right. Like, you have to be present first and foremost. Like, you have to spend time and you have to get to know them. Right. Like, you have to get to know your guys, like what makes them tick. So to do that, it just takes time. My former boss, one of my ADs here, asked me, you know, tell me what you do without using the word basketball coach. Right. Like, so you have to explain your job without using the word basketball coach. And so I thought it was a great question. And I answered it by saying, I just build relationships, right? I happen to use basketball to build relationships. That's what I do. If I was a banker, I would use banking to build relationships, but it's all about relationships. Like, so I feel like I've used basketball to create my life, right? Like, so my relationship with you guys are because speaking at Jay Bill's camp, you asked me to be on the podcast, right? It was all basketball related, right? But it was all about relationships. My relationships with my players' parents, with, like, they know me. I got to know them because I recruited them, or my relationship with Bob McKillop, my relationship with, there's so many, many examples of basketball that help me build relationships, right? And that, using the game of basketball to build those relationships is so important. That's why we treat it with our guys. Like, hey, you're at Emory. You're here to play basketball, right? But you're also here, you're going to meet these unbelievable people. Like, hopefully they think I'm unbelievable.
Right. Hopefully they count you as one of those guys.
Yeah, they think I'm crazy as heck. I know that. I know that for sure. But you're going to meet these. And part of the reason you came to Emory was to play basketball. Like, so use that in your life. Like, you use it. Use that relationship building. And I think that's so vital, that relationship piece. Hey, they're not going to like me all the time. I'm okay with that. They're okay with that. And I tell them, I'm not going to like you all the time either. That's okay. It's not personally. Like, I like you as a person, right? But there's some things that you're going to do that I'm not going to like. There's decisions that I make that you may not agree with, right? That's okay if you understand the person. Like, hey, this person is in it for Emory basketball, or like, I'm in it to make you better, to help you be better. If they don't trust that, then we have problems, because if you don't have that trust, then the decisions that you make are always questioned, or the decisions that they make as a player are always questioned, right? So that comes with everything that we do is building that relationship, right? Like, whether it's, hey, I'm going to meet with you tomorrow at 8:30. We're going to talk about your chemistry class. Well, he shows up at 8:45. Well, that's bad. Like, that's not building our trust, right? Or he shows up at 8:15 and he's got notes ready for the meeting and he's ready to talk to me about, hey, great. Like, you know, that's building relationship. That has nothing to do with basketball. Zero to do with basketball. But it's that relationship building that now, hey, I have to have you, you know, switching a ball screen. Well, you switch the ball screen late. Well, you came late to your meeting at 8:45 this morning. Like, that's a problem.
Right.
And so those relationships are constantly, you know, every day we work on those relationships. You know, every day you got to work on the relationship with your kids or your wife or your boss, or, you know, it's part of life. And that part of it is, if you can get good at that, if you can become good at it, if you enjoy that, like, you can live a really successful and happy life, I feel.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that I'm going to quote Greg White from Arkansas here. He says the ball has magic in it, and I think that it's true. I think when you look at your life, when I look at my life, when Jason thinks about his life, and you think about the impact that basketball has had on all of us and the people that I know through the game and have had the good fortune of being able to meet, it all comes back to using the relationships that I've made through the game of basketball to make my life better, and hopefully in some small way making the lives of those people who I've built relationships with better as well. I want to start to wrap up here, Jason, because we're coming up on an hour and a half. So here's what
you
I'd
told
like
me
you to.
We were going to talk for an hour and a half. I said, hey, you were crazy, and now we could probably go for.
We
got
right. I feel like we could easily double it without much question. Yeah. I feel like there's a whole bunch of stuff. We're gonna have to have you back on at some point. So here's what I want to do. Share out how people can get in touch with you. Give them some contact information, and then if there's anything that we didn't hit on that you want to leave kind of a parting shot before we get out of here, go ahead and do that too.
Sure. Best thing to do is email. It's JZIMME and the number 4 at Emory.edu. It's the best place to reach me. And parting shots, you know, we talked about a lot, you know, and basketball has been really good to me. And we've worked really hard at it, right? But it's taken me overseas many times. It's taken me to meet guys like Bob McKillop and get my education at Davidson. And if you told me at 18 years old in Warsaw, Indiana, that I would be coaching one of the premier, you know, universities in the country, Emory University, when I'm 47 years old and coaching tremendous young men and teaching basketball, I would have signed the contract like in a second, right? If you had told me I'd been able to do that in my life, and just all the people that have helped and been a part of that is have been really special to me, and those relationships that we talked about have just been make your life really special. And like you said, the basketball has magic in it. And if I think we talked about this early, we're just trying to add value to what the situations that we're in, right? All of us. And if all of us can do that, if we can add value to wherever we go, and make it a little bit better of a place, whether it be at Emory University, or if somebody listens to the podcast, or I go and have a dinner and meet somebody, if I can add value to something, if we all can do that, then hey, the world's going to be a lot better place. And so I do really appreciate you having me on and talking. We probably rambled too much. You probably found out too much about Jason Zimmerman, but but yeah, that's I really appreciate you having me on and being able to talk a little bit.
No, it was an absolute pleasure to have this conversation. We can't thank you enough for taking an hour and a half out of your schedule to jump on with us and share with our audience all the great things they have going at Emory. And just, it's always fascinating to learn somebody's backstory. You know, we meet briefly at Jay Billis. I get a chance to hear you talk, and now here we are. We sat down and talked for an hour and a half, and hopefully it's a start of a relationship that we can continue to build and work on. So we want to thank you for jumping on with us, and to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.